Welcome to the Materials Universe podcast, where we will explore the materials world and how it shapes our lives. My name is Bailey Tibbett, and I will be your host this season. Please join me as I interview researchers from the Center for Dynamics and Control of Materials at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Today, I have with me Audrey Colgrove, our podcast manager, and a special guest with us, Dr. Tanya Betancourt.
Hi, everyone. Dr. Tanya Betancourt is joining us from Texas State University, where she is a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry. Tanya is also the director of the PREM program over at Texas State. The MRSEC here has been partnered with PREM for, I believe, the past 3 years. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tanya.
4 years.
4 years. Amazing.
Our fifth year now.
Amazing. And we have had a bunch of wonderful opportunities to collaborate between our labs. And so we're here today to talk about Dr. Tanya Betancourt. So hello. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Audrey. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate this opportunity.
Wonderful. Well, we wanted to start by asking you about your research over at Texas State. And today we are particularly interested in your nano-conjugated photothermal system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure thing. So the system that you're discussing is these nanoparticles that we can utilize as agents for photothermal therapies of cancer. These are basically based on a polymeric nanoparticle made out of PDOT or polyethylene dioxythiophene. And the key capability that these particles have is that they absorb light in the near infrared range, which is a light that can penetrate through the skin and through tissues more easily than UV or visible light because it doesn't interact with biological molecules. And because of that, it can penetrate more deeply and also it can kind of prevent causing damage to the tissues. And so the idea of those nanoparticles is to administer them to the patient, to have them locate at the site of a cancer, for example, and then to be able to utilize near-infrared light that is controlled externally, maybe by the doctor or the surgeon, to be able to exert therapeutic effect directly at the tumor site. And this project actually started from a very different project. We were working with Dr. Jennifer Irvin here at Texas State University on developing a biosensor where we were utilizing conductive polymers as the the material that was able to provide an electrical signal upon detection of the biological molecules of interest. And in the process of characterizing that material, we found out that the polymer absorbed light in the near infrared range. And that's where this second project that we have been going on for the past few years began. Basically started working with Jennifer Irvin and also with the lab of Dr. James Tunnell at UT Austin in the biomedical engineering department. We worked together to take that same material that we originally had as films and make it into nanoparticles that could be suspended in aqueous media because our bodies are mainly aqueous systems. And then to be able to kind of, you know, investigate the properties of those nanoparticles and demonstrate whether or not they could be utilized for photothermal therapies.
So correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds like you are suspending these nanoparticles in an aqueous solution to be injected into like a tumor site for a cancer patient.
Yes.
And then using infrared light to interact with the nanoparticles. And that is part of like killing the cancer, affecting it?
Yeah, that's right. So first of all, in terms of the administration of the nanoparticles, they could be injected locally or in the future, maybe they could be administered kind of intravenously and have them hopefully preferentially located at the tumor because of some of the characteristics of the tumor vasculature that is more leaky than your normal healthy tissue vasculature. But the nanoparticles by themselves don't do anything. It is only when you have both nanoparticles and the laser light together that you have the therapeutic effect. And what the therapeutic effect is basically that photothermal transformation. Basically, the light is absorbed by the nanoparticles and that energy is converted into heat. So that photothermal light going into heat. And it is the heat that would cause the therapeutic effect. Basically, you are heating up the cancer cells to the point where you do irreversible damage. That could be by denaturing proteins, by damaging the cell membrane, and basically inducing enough stress on the cell that the cell dies. We have been able to demonstrate that in vitro, so in basically studies that we do in the lab with cells that are cultured. We have done investigation with both breast cancer cells as well as melanoma cells. And we have done also some work that kind of investigates whether we can kill the cancer cells in such a way that they go through this process called immunogenic cell death, where the cells basically kind of present some biomolecules to the outside of the cell that would potentially interface with immune cells and kind of act like a eat me signal, like, you know, I'm a cell that shouldn't be here, come and recognize me. And if there's any of these cells that are left over, recognize them and take care of them. So again, we're basically trying to investigate whether we can induce immunogenic cell death, because that could pave the way for potential use of this therapeutic modality together with immunotherapies that would not just eradicate the local cancer, but maybe if there's a metastasis or something like that, that the immune system could then take care of those other leftover cells, if that makes sense.
You can't see me, but my jaw is fully on the floor.
Thank you.
So it sounds like it's like smart medicine almost.
That's the idea, that we have some kind of control over how this works, right? That the material by itself has capabilities, but that we can have an external control to activate it so that hopefully it doesn't cause as much damage to the healthy tissue, but it has more of a, you know, activated or controlled effect on the cells that we do want to treat. So yeah, in a way it is intelligent materials for medicine.
I guess I do have a question about the system in general, but how do the nanoparticles like find the cancer cells, if that makes sense? Like, how do they delineate between a healthy cell and a cancer cell?
Right. So as I mentioned, you could have two different administration routes. One could be just local injection, in which case just, you know, wherever the nanoparticles are injected, that's where they would go to. But if you do administer the nanoparticles intravenously, the idea of all of the cancer nanomedicines is that they take advantage of the leaky vasculature of the tumors, which basically means that as the tumors grow, they actually develop their own vasculature, their own blood vessels, to be able to sustain the growing mass of cells that initially was not there, right? For those cancer cells to be alive, they actually need nutrients to come in. And so they actually develop their own blood vessels. And when they do that, they do it in a way that is not as perfect as normal tissue would have been. So you get this vasculature that has kind of big fenestrations or big separations in between the cells that enable nanocarriers, so particles that are maybe between 10 and 200 nanometers, to escape into the tumor tissue more easily than they would have into normal tissues. And that's kind of the premise of all of the cancer nanomedicines that have been investigated over the past, you know, few decades already. Now that works to a point, and I will go ahead and say we have not done any in vivo studies with our nanoparticles. So all of the work that we have done so far has been in vitro, you know, in a dish, in a lightest as well plate kind of thing. And eventually we will have to test this in animals and, you know, from there in humans if we get that far. But yeah, the idea is that we would take advantage of that leakiness of the tumor tissue. And I mentioned that it works to a point because a lot of the research over the last two decades or so has shown that nanoparticles do preferentially go to the tumors, but they also accumulate in the liver and the spleen. And that, you know, from one perspective, it lowers the efficacy at the tumor site because those particles are not getting to where you want them to go, but they could also potentially cause some problems. And so that's something that will need to be investigated in vivo.
Wow, that's so cool. It sounds like this research has a lot of like potential for like future applications and stuff. Can you tell us a bit about how the research kind of fits into the PREM Center that Audrey was talking about at the beginning?
Yeah, sure. So, by the way, the PREM stands for the Partnership for Research and Education in Materials. So it is funded by the National Science Foundation, and it is a program that looks to open opportunities to minority-serving institutions to conduct material science research in partnership with a large NSF-funded center, such as the MRSEC at UT Austin. And basically, because we're doing material science research, that is, you know, one of the key topics that we're investigating. Now, here in our prem, we actually have, I guess, 9 faculty members, or actually 10 right now, 10 faculty members that are involved doing research. And it's not just biomedical research. We have research in all areas, including materials for semiconductors, materials for energy, for nanoelectronics, materials for water purification, and materials also for medical applications. Now, where this particular project fits in is that we were able to partner with the lab of Dr. Adrian Rosales from Chemical Engineering at UT Austin. They had been working on these hydrogel systems that have a range of applications, including drug delivery. And their hydrogel systems are based on this kind of reversible covalent bonds that make them dynamic, that make them kind of intelligent in a way. They are able to respond to stimuli. And so we were able to take our nanoparticles from the prior work on cancer therapies and combine them with their hydrogels to be able to make a composite system where we could utilize light to cause localized heat within the hydrogels by using our nanoparticles. And that heat within the hydrogels could then kind of activate the function of the hydrogels to be able to deliver drugs on demand. So that's kind of where we began the collaboration with Dr. Rosales through the PREM partnership.
That's a really cool, like, time release type synergy, I think.
Right.
Especially since a lot of time release medicine right now is stomach based, I believe.
Right, right. Yes. So what we envision later would be something where we could, you know, have a patient that needs kind of frequent administration, but not necessarily continuous administration, maybe like for diabetes, mm-hmm. where the patient could inject themselves with the hydrogel. The hydrogel could reside under their skin and it could act like a reservoir for the drug, in this example, for insulin. And then you could have a life source, maybe eventually something like a smartwatch that could be turned on and off to enable the drug release on demand by utilizing the photothermal effect.
Wow.
And this is very much down the road. that's the idea.
Wow. Okay. So how did the system come about? Was there like an initial inspiration for you or folks in your lab when you were working on this?
I also have a training in hydrogels from my doctoral and postdoctoral work. And so when I saw their publication, the work that they were doing, it just seemed like a great fit for us to be able to collaborate where, you know, we would utilize a material that they already had a lot of experience with. And also we could utilize the material that we had a lot of experience with and kind of put them together for this goal. And it has panned out really well. I mean, it's provided really interesting projects for our students to work on. And it's been really collaborative. We've learned, I mean, from Adrian, we've learned all of everything about rheology, which is kind of investigating the mechanical properties of the hydrogels, which is something that we had never done and we don't have the capability to do here. We've also learned some synthesis from them. So it's been really, really good. It's been a really great partnership.
What was it you said recently, Bailey? The C in MRSEC is for collaboration?
Yes. Yes, MRSEC is very collaborative, I think.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, it's really cool that like the collaboration has some pretty tangible research results. Are there other ways that the collaboration between Texas State and PREM with UT's MRSEC, is there any like other effects that you've seen kind of as the director of the center?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, there's the publications, not just from my lab and my collaboration with Arian, but from other labs as well. There has been many highlights. I mean, one of the highlights that comes to mind is with Dr. Yoichi Miyahara's group here at Texas State. He develops kind of new instrumentation and new techniques to characterize materials. And that has been really enabling for some of the faculty at UT Austin. I know he collaborates with Elaine Lee and Ken Shi, and you know, they have had a really good partnership where they're being able to utilize the newly invented instruments here to be able to kind of gain knowledge about the materials that they are developing there. So that has gone really well. Obviously, there's also a lot of educational impact from the partnership. I mean, one thing that comes to mind right now is the industrial mentorship program. that UT Austin organizes. Our students have taken advantage of that, many of them actually, and they have really enjoyed it. I know two of our students have either obtained jobs through it or kind of indirectly been able to find jobs through that mentorship program. And that's been really, really helpful here at Texas State, and especially in the departments that are involved in our prem, which are chemistry and physics for the most part. There's not a lot of kind of connection to industry, unfortunately. And so having that pathway through the MERSEC has been really, really helpful.
Well, speaking of mentorship, we know that you mentor quite the variety of undergraduate and graduate researchers in your lab. Can you speak to like your mentoring relationships with all of your students and what that's like for you?
Sure, sure. I've been trying to figure that out. It's transitioned significantly, you know, over the years. When I first started at Texas State, you know, I didn't have children. I had a lot of time. And so the students were my children, and I was able to spend a lot of time and kind of, they became kind of part of my family. So I really loved being able to interact a lot with them kind of on a daily basis individually. But that has had to change because of time constraints and, you know, being able to manage, you know, work and life balance. So I do try to still maintain kind of a good relationship with the students where they feel like they can come to me and ask questions and, you know, bring up ideas. I tell them that my philosophy is to kind of allow them to gain ownership. So, you know, we train them, but then we give you ownership, and I do ensure that they have the opportunity to make mistakes and to learn from those mistakes and to learn the troubleshooting. So I think that's kind of the most exciting part of our research. Like, it never works on the first try, right? And so being able to overcome those challenges, that really is what I think makes research so exciting. And so I make sure that the students have that kind of opportunity to gain ownership of their projects and start writing their own protocols and start changing the parameters and running into obstacles, running into problems, and learning how to face those problems. But yeah, so in terms of how we do the mentorship and things, that has changed over time. Nowadays, I have a big group right now. I think I have 5 PhD students, and I had a master's students that just graduated this semester, and a group of 5 undergraduate students as well. And so it's been challenging to be able to have one-on-one time with each of them. But we try to have weekly meetings, either individually or as a small groups. And then we also have the large group meeting where we will talk about the research of one person, and we also talk about literature, publications from the literature. But
I always think it's a little suspicious if a research project works the first time around, for sure. Yeah. It's something I learned very quickly. When it does happen, it's like even more suspicious. You mentioned like all these like skills that you're trying to develop amongst your mentees. Do you have any kind of like golden advice for any future researcher out there that wants to also develop these skills, or any advice that you kind of really emphasize with your mentees?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I teach them is to really be open to opportunities. So in my own personal pathway in research has not been linear. It has not been, you know, the perfect thing of you go to get your bachelor's and you go straight to get your PhD or such. And so I make sure that the students understand that it doesn't have to be one way only, that there's many paths, and open your ears for any kind of opportunities, for scholarships, for research here and elsewhere. Also, it's hugely important for students to build a network of mentors, not just one person, but a couple of people that are invested in them and that can point out those opportunities that they might not know about. What else? I definitely tell them that, you know, they have to see the beauty in research, in all of the aspects of research, that they will face challenges for sure along the way, but that they should kind of cherish those. And they'll look back on those problems like, oh, I was able to overcome that, you know, when it finally worked. So they should kind of cherish it, appreciate it, because, you know, we have that opportunity to be able to participate in this kind of research. Not everybody gets a chance to, you know, spend 40 hours kind of tinkering with materials to try to make them do what you want them to do, right?
It's kind of a pet project.
It's a privilege to be able to do that. So enjoy it for sure. And then also the other thing is to pass it on. You know, once they have been able to have these doors open for them, that they also spend some time being able to open doors for other students, you know, for people in the K-12 system or to more junior undergraduate students and such. Yeah, I think that's very important.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Like something that I think we like to highlight on this podcast, aside from, you know, the center's research and whatnot, is kind of a little bit of like the mentorship and then passing it on. Like you said, like that concept of, you know, allowing people to have more opportunities that they can take advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
Something we also like to highlight, and you kind of touched on this a bit, is the diversity and career path in terms of becoming a researcher, becoming a professor. You said that yours was a little more unconventional than most. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, sure, sure. So I came from Colombia. I finished my high school in Colombia. I was fortunate enough that my family had been in the U.S. for a very long period of time. And so when I did come to the U.S., I came already with my green card. And so I had the opportunity to start college very soon after that. So, you know, that was the first door that was open to me. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do. In Colombia, I thought that I was going to go and study physics because I had an amazing teacher that just made it sound so cool. But then when I got here, you know, I was exposed to different things. And so I ended up changing majors. But I changed majors into chemical engineering just because my chemistry professor here told me that that would be a good major for me. I had no idea what chemical engineering really was until I was very deep into it already.
Yeah, the plot twist is nothing to do with chemicals unless it ends in like a carbon copy, usually like hexane or something.
Yeah, and I did my chemical engineering degree at Texas A&M, which at that point was very much focused on the petrochemical industry. So as you said, it had very little to do with chemistry. It was mostly about, you know, plant design and working in a chemical plant to produce things. I had the opportunity to do a co-op at DuPont, which was great. It was a really great experience, but it also made me realize that that was not what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so I did finish my Bachelor's of Science in Chemical Engineering, and I did enjoy studying it, but I didn't want to work in a chemical plant for the rest of my life. So that's when I switched. So I went back to graduate school after working for a little while with DuPont. I went back to grad school to get my master's and PhD in biomedical engineering, where I knew that I could use a little bit of the chemistry that I had learned and a little bit of the chemical engineering that I had learned, but for an application that was much more interesting to me. And I had the fortune of working with Lisa Brannon Pepas and Nicolas Pepas in this world of biomaterials that I didn't really know anything about. I actually did not do research as an undergraduate. I had no idea that that opportunity existed. Nobody told me. As I mentioned at Texas A&M at that point, the focus was really on industry. So everybody was doing internships and co-ops in industry. I had no idea that research was something that, you know, that I could engage on, which is funny looking back because I did have a lot of graduate student friends, but the conversation never came to like, oh, you could do this. So anyways, then I went to grad school and it was a little rough. Again, I had never done research. I didn't know what being a grad student entailed at all. And my research group with Lisa Brannon Pepas, I was actually the first graduate student in that group. And so there was the next challenge of not having a student mentor that I could learn from as to how do you do research. She did have a couple of undergraduate students who trained me on what they knew. But, you know, those first 2 years were very challenging in getting my learning how to be a graduate student, how to do research from point zero, and then eventually succeeding in that. But yeah, I mean, there were a lot of challenging times through grad school. And then after grad school, I actually didn't know what I wanted to do, even at that point. So I ended up going to industry. I worked in a small company called Innocence LLC, where basically we had the opportunity to develop new technologies in all kinds of materials areas. So when I joined, they were making kind of creating new materials that could be used for like sensing applications, not biomedical necessarily, but, you know, sensing applications for gases and for maybe hydrogen and other kind of analytes. They were also making materials that were engineered for like anti-fog coatings or flame retardant materials. So a very diverse kind of project set. And that was really interesting. I got to apply kind of the basic concepts of material science and engineering to a range of applications that I had never considered. But they also allowed me to put together my own proposals for small business innovation research grants from the government to develop my own biomedical kind of projects. And I was able to get funding. And so that's kind of when I gained the confidence that I could maybe go back to academia, because I I didn't think that I could, but I actually was able to come up with new ideas and get funding for them. And so that gave me the confidence to kind of start looking into academic positions. I knew I loved the university environment and I loved working with students, but I really liked that confidence of being able to come up with ideas that was necessary. So yeah, I kind of bounced a little bit, and I didn't really mention that I went to community college, in fact, two community colleges before I got to Texas A&M. And then I went, you know, to Texas A&M, UT Austin for graduate school, industry, and then somehow I was able to find a position in academia. As you might know, positions in academia, typically the applicants go through a normal pathway of, you know, finishing grad school, going to a postdoctoral position for a couple of years, maybe two postdoctoral positions, and then they apply to academic positions. So it's very rare for a faculty member to have gone through industry and be recruited directly from industry back into academia. So that was another door that was open for me that, I don't know, somehow the stars aligned.
So I'm interested in the fact that your graduate experience almost mirrors your undergraduate experience in some way, because, you know, coming over as an international student, you were kind of dropped in without, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, a certain amount of support. And then the same thing almost happened with your graduate group. Can you expand on how this might have shaped your experience as a researcher?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, there were a lot of people that came in to help, right? Yeah. I'll just go ahead and mention the first community college that I went to. I came with no money. I came to maybe study English for a little bit, for a semester. I registered for classes and I didn't pay because I didn't have money. And then the professors noticed that I got dropped from the class, but I kept coming to the class. They were the ones who took me to financial aid and told me about this thing called financial aid that I was qualified for, that I had no idea existed, of course. I just wanted to learn. Yeah. So you know, there's been a lot of people like that came to the rescue and kind of helped me go to the next step. But yeah, maybe that has shaped me in some ways. And I mean, one of the ways is kind of having that sense of how important it is for us to pay it forward now that we are at this on the other side, right? Now that we have all of this information, making sure that others get that chance as well. Others who might not know that, they also get that information and are able to get the doors open for them as well. Also in grad school, as you mentioned, the fact that there were no other graduate students in that lab also meant that I had to kind of develop additional skills, right? In terms of like going through the lab and trying to figure out, be more resourceful as to how can I get, you know, how can I develop a new protocol? And so that has been really helpful in setting up my own lab and learning how to troubleshoot without necessarily having somebody else tell you what to do. And that's something that I hope that my students also try to get here.
Well, I love that. I've worked with many of your students and I definitely see in them some of these aspects of genuine curiosity and desire to share their science with everyone around them. And I've always really appreciated and respected that about both you and your students that I've worked with. It's been really wonderful.
Yeah, I think you mentioned kind of just the stars aligning, but it sounds like you actually did a lot of really intense learning and work to get to where you are. So I think that's always very amazing. And it's really inspiring to hear for sure.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I've had a good group of mentors that, again, have been able to point me in the right direction. But then you're right, you know, then taking the leap and actually getting it done, applying for these things and putting a foot forward saying, yes, I can do this. Well, at least giving it a try, you know. The worst thing that could happen is that it doesn't work out and then you just pivot. So, yeah, you do have to have a little bit of guts to go after those opportunities.
Yeah, and I think in research, too, you always have to be your own biggest cheerleader because things fail so often and opportunities come and go that it's kind of like you really just learn to love the small things.
Exactly.
That's something we talk a lot about at the MRSEC because, you know, every year we're getting new undergraduates or graduate students who maybe have limited experience in research. And we're always talking about how to kind of help teach that reaction to failure, like teach how to keep knuckling through and work through the failure in like a really healthy way that means you grow instead of just kind of shrink back, which is hard.
Right. That's such a key part of research. I mean, again, most of the times research doesn't work on the first, second, or third try, right? So you just have to keep on trying to learn every single time to see what went wrong, or, you know, maybe one of your assumptions was wrong and we need to change the hypothesis or something like that. Yeah. So
are there any big challenges you've faced in your research career, specifically maybe with the work at Texas State?
Let's see. I mean, one of the challenges in the career, I mean, not necessarily specific to Texas State or to the Prem, is just work-life balance. Mm. That's a challenge that I think everyone faces in their life, regardless of at what point in your life you're at, right? You know, for me, it's been a challenge since I had my two little girls. I have a 3-year-old and an almost 6-year-old. It's been pretty hard to try to balance having enough time to have quality time with them, and at the same time being able to, you know, not just get things done here at work, but being able to like grow all of these programs and maintain them and drive them. That takes a lot of time, a lot of dedication. And so definitely trying to identify help wherever it comes. Yeah. that's basically the way that I have been able to find that balance, right? Whether that's help at home with family members or other people, or whether there's finding help here from our staff for the Prem or other faculty members or students in my group or students in the Prem, kind of delegating or trying to find that help wherever it comes from.
They always say, you know, it takes a village to raise kiddos, but I think it also takes a village to do some research is what I'm really hearing.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, so one of the themes of this podcast for this season that we like to look at is kind of looking at materials that are exciting for the future. Are there any, like, materials, like biomaterials or otherwise, that you can't wait to tell your kids about, or you're just, like, so excited to see how it'll impact their lives?
Yeah, I mean, in my area, nowadays, we're looking to use materials to, you know, grow tissues, tissue engineering. That whole field is so exciting. There has been a lot of development, a lot of great work showing that either we can, you know, build organs or something like it, or that we can kind of start learning how just changing one parameter can affect the behavior of cells. And it has so much potential, not just for tissue engineering itself, but also for developing models for diseases so that we can do a lot of investigation in vitro, that I'm very excited to see where all of that goes.
That's so cool. This might be kind of dated by now, but I remember seeing like a viral image online a few years ago of some, like, a lab grew an ear.
The ear.
Oh, like on a mouse or something.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, I'm glad y'all remember this, because I had it in my brain and I was like, what if it's not real?
No, it's definitely real.
Yeah. Good idea.
That seems like some nightmare material that I would have made up, though. Well, wonderful. Thank you so, so much for joining us here on the Materials Universe, Tanya. It was so wonderful having you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity. And yeah, I look forward to continuing the partnership with the MERSEC.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, we wish you the best in your research.
That's all for today's episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Thank you for listening to our interesting conversations with inspiring guests from different fields of science and engineering. We hope you enjoyed learning something new. Please leave us a review and share this podcast with friends. You can follow us on social media at TexasCDCM on Instagram and X. Thank you to the National Science Foundation and the University of Texas at Austin. And an additional thank you to the Late's Audio Studio crew for their help with the production of this podcast.